Hello, I'm Kristen Marchand, and this is the Opiongo Line. A happy Thanksgiving to you, one and all, whether you're out there this weekend living in or visiting the Upper Madawaska or Opiongo River Valleys, or possibly living in or visiting one of those far-flung places on the World Wide Web, where we know you are one of over 10,000 people downloading our podcasts. It's amazing to think that we now have Opiongo Line listeners in over 36 countries, from New Zealand to Norway, Brazil to Belarus. Who knew our local culture and unique heritage would interest people from so far away? Unless, as we suspect, many of those listeners out there in the global village have a personal connection with our mighty Madawaska or Opiongo River Valleys. Stranger things are possible. Take, for instance, the possibility that especially over the previous few decades, just maybe, some of our more adventurous, if not vagabond locals, have wandered off to those far four corners of the world and where they have happily set up shop. And despite being thousands and thousands of miles away, they have never forgotten who they are or where they came from. The same, they say, is true for time travel. Sometimes, the very things we think may have been lost forever, lost somewhere back in the fog of a shared cultural history, well, it can all of a sudden come back to us in some very curious ways. Take, for instance, this very special Thanksgiving show. It was conceived and produced by one of our Opiongo Readers Theatre members from Maynooth, Anne K. Wild. Although not Indigenous, Anne decided about a year ago that she wanted to learn more about the local Indigenous heritage and culture. So, she went looking. The show you are about to hear is what she found, a rare and unique glimpse into local First Nations heritage and culture, that is to say, the Algonquins of the Upper Ottawa Valley. And though most of us are familiar with the Algonquins of Pequoctagon, who are centered at Golden Lake, few of us know much of their essential culture that is now being broadly spread throughout Ontario, and especially here in the Upper Ottawa Valley. Today's show looks at one of those locations, the Hastings Highlands, that run along the York River Valley from Combermere through Bancroft and well into Algonquin Park. Though we can't promise that over the next hour you will become an expert in the local Algonquin culture, no more than we could promise, say, by reading some of Aesop's fables you will understand all there is to know of Greek culture, but rather, the show you are about to hear is meant only as an appetizer. A foretaste of what awaits if only you explore just a little deeper. Here, then, is Anne K. Wild's Algonquin Voices.
Kwe Anin. Hello. Welcome to the Opiongo Line podcast, Algonquin Voices. I am your host, Anne Wild, a Jaganashikwe non-native woman, joining you from Maynooth, which is located near Bancroft, Ontario. I acknowledge that we are gathered on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabeg, which is known by Indigenous peoples as unceded. In this podcast, you will hear songs, folk tales, and legends of Algonquin culture, generously shared by the members of the Gitiko Manito, Algonquin First Nation, who reside in the North Hastings County in the province of Ontario, Canada. The Algonquins call themselves Anishinaabe, which means First Peoples. The Algonquin people have lived in the Ottawa Valley region for at least 8,000 years, long before the Europeans arrived in North America. The Algonquin heartland has always included the entire length of the Ottawa River, from its headwaters in north-central Ontario to its outlet in Montreal. The Shawashkong Ikwe Singers is a women's drumming and singing group who are members of the Gitiko Manito Madaskurini Algonquin First Nation, located in Bancroft. The name of the group is important, as Shawashkong is what the Algonquin people call river, now known as the York River. Ikwe is the Algonquin word for woman or women. The group started a drumming and singing circle in April of 2018 as a way of bringing together the women of the Algonquin community to learn about their culture and to make the community stronger through traditional hand drumming and songs. Through their many performances throughout the Bancroft area, they are able to showcase one aspect of their culture and remind audiences that the Algonquin people have lived on this territory since time immemorial. Today, there are Algonquin women of all ages who come together to drum and sing. You will now meet three of these women. They will introduce themselves first in Algonquin, then in English.
Kwe, Aden Indigenakaz, Wapshishina Dodum, Kijiko Manitou Madawaskuini Ndojiba, Omamo Nini Nishnabe Ikwe Ndao. Hi, Ada is my name, Martin is my clan, Kijiko Manitou Madawaskuini Algonquin Nation in Bancroft is my home, and I am an Anishinaabe woman.
Kwe, Noreen Nindijnikaz, Wabshishi Ndodim, Kijiko Manitou Madawaskuini Ndonjima, Omamo Winini Anishinaabe Kwe Ndel. Hello, Noreen is my name. I am from the Martin clan. Kijiko Manitou Madawaskuini is my community, and I am an Algonquin Anishinaabe woman.
Kwe Diane Indigenakaz Wabashishi Nidodum Kijiko Manitou Madawaskuini Nidonjnaba Omama Winini Inishinaabe Ikwe Endow. Hi, Diane is my name. I'm from the Martin clan, from the Kijiko Manitou Madawaskuini Algonquin Nation in Bancroft, Ontario, and I am an Algonquin Anishinaabe woman. So I'm going to introduce the Algonquin water song. This song is traditionally done with water sticks and sung facing each of the four directions. And the meaning of the song is, "The water that I carry is the blood of Mother Earth."
Baptiste Lake is a large, beautiful lake located in Herschel Township, Bancroft. This lake is approximately 2,226 hectares and part of a three-lake chain with Benoit Lake and Elephant Lake. The lake has had a few different names throughout its history: Kaijik Manitou, Loon Lake, Long Lake, and then finally was named Baptiste Lake, after Chief John Baptiste, whose family is believed to be the first original residents of the area. The legend of this lake is read by Noreen Tinney, a member of the Baptiste family.
The Baptiste Lake Legend. In Baptiste Lake waters grow white water lilies, which, according to the legend of the Algonquin people, were once travelers from the stars. However, Baptiste Lake has a water lily rosy and pink, which grows nowhere else in North Hastings. The story goes that a radiantly beautiful maiden, glowing like the star which was her home, came to dwell with a tribe of natives who had earned her love. Finding a suitable home for a star maiden was not easy. She tried to live on a hilltop, but she could not see the women grinding corn. She tried the trees, but the foliage would not let her see the children at play. She tried a flowery meadow, but the children's laughter was but an echo. She reasoned that the people she loved always camped by the waters, which carried their canoes from place to place, especially from Baptiste Lake to Whitney. To be near them, the water must be her home. While the Baptiste family slept, she floated lightly to the water where their campfires were reflected, and where when the band awakened, they found her with her feet planted firmly in the water's bed. Her pearly petals were spread wide to receive the blessed sun, and her golden heart spread perfume abroad. Forever a living gift of love and beauty, her roots provided nourishment for her people when all other food sources failed. Perhaps the rosy water lilies growing around Baptiste Lake Island are the Star Maiden's special tribute to the native family which gave the lake its name, and, like the travelers from beyond the stars, would not be parted from its waters. Chimiigwech, all my relations.
Frank G. Speck was an American anthropologist and professor at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in the Algonquin and Iroquoian peoples among the Eastern Woodland Native Americans of the United States and First Nations peoples of Eastern Boreal Canada. Frank Speck was unique among many anthropologists of his generation in choosing to study First Nations communities close to home rather than people of more distant lands. The pressures of relocation, boarding schools, cultural assimilation, and economic marginalization had, however, caused many Indigenous people to lose traditional lands, material, and culture. Speck found his work constituted, in effect, a salvage operation to try to capture the ethnological material during a time of great stress for Indigenous people. His efforts included regions in Ontario, where he developed maps of individual family bands' hunting territories to document Algonquin land rights. These later became crucial to present-day land claims. In 1915, he wrote a field study based on his findings of some Algonquins living along the Ottawa River between Temiskaming and Allumette Island. You will now meet two more members of the Shawashquang Ikwe Singers, Mary Cannon and Ava Anderson, who will read a collection of folk tales gathered by Frank Speck. They will first introduce themselves in Algonquin, then in English.
Kwe Mary Nadinjakaz Wabashishi Nadodum Maynuth Nadinjaba Omamimi Anishinaabe Kwe Indau. Hi, I'm Mary. Martin is my clan. I live in Maynuth. I'm an Algonquin Anishinaabe woman.
Kwe Ava Nadinjakaz Wabashishi Nadodem Maynuth Nindonjaba Omamuanini Anishinaabe Kwe Zans Indau. Hello, my name is Ava. I am of the Martin clan. I live in Maynooth, and I am an Algonquin girl. Weendigo, a man-eating creature who roams through the woods, devouring luckless victims. He is believed to have been a hunter who became lost in the bush and lost all his provisions and clothing. He preyed upon anything he could find, like an animal.
Pegook, a creature of bones, a skeleton that clatters through the forest, making a great rattling and squeaking noise. When this is heard, it is understood as an omen that some friend will be lost. Pegook once was a hunter who starved out in the bush, but before he died, he wished that his life and the strength of his flesh might be transferred to his bones. He got his wish, and his strength went into his bones when his flesh fell away. Whenever he wished, he could fly through the air as though on wings.
Ojig, the constellation Ursa Major, the Great Bear or the Big Dipper. The Algonquins called Ojig, meaning fisher or black cat. The four main stars of constellation form the body of the animal. The stars trailing behind the handle of the dipper represents the fisher's or cat's tail. The story accounts how various animals tried to reach the North Star, but eventually froze to death. The fisher is still trying to reach it, and he is the nearest, but he only keeps going around and around, representing the revolution on the constellation about the North Star without being able to get there.
Wawate. The northern lights are called Wawate, or illumination. According to legend, the Northern Lights are caused by the waves splashing the rocky shores of the Northern Seas, or James Bay, which produce a sort of reflected glow. The seething noise, which is sometimes heard when the aura is visible, is attributed to the grinding of the rocks and gravel along the shore of the sea, driven by the action of water and wind in the north. The Algonquin think that within 2 days after the aurora becomes visible, they will get a heavy windstorm. They also state that wild geese require a day and a night to reach them from James Bay when they migrate, thus showing the speed of the wind by comparison.
Taguanibisan. The rainbow is called Taguanibisan and forms from the water. Since the phenomenon is believed to be caused by the mist from breakers on some great body of water, just as a rainbow will appear above the spray, along the seashore or hanging in the mist above some waterfalls.
Chibikanwa. The Milky Way in Algonquin is called Kibichanwa, meaning a bird's path, because it is by the Milky Way that the fowl and the birds follow their northward or southward course in their migrations. It guides them southward in the autumn and back again in the spring.
Seeing a white animal. To see a white animal is a sign of bad luck for a hunter. Once a man went hunting, and after he had been traveling all day and taken a few animals, he saw a bear that was half black and half white. Then he said to himself, "I must not hunt any more this trip. If I do, some harm will come to my family." So he went home. If a hunter sees an albino animal, he must stop hunting, or evil will befall him or some member of his family.
Seeing a dwarfed animal. To find a dwarfed animal is an omen of misfortune. Once two men were out on a long hunting trip. Soon after they had begun trapping, they found a dwarfed beaver in one of the traps. It was not small because it was young, but they could see it was an old one, but much undersized. When the older of the two men saw this, he said, "We must go home at once and give up hunting, because something is wrong at home." Although they had been gone only a short time, they turned back, and when they got home, they found out that one of his sons was dead and that the family was waiting to bury him.
Burnt partridge bone. To foretell what kind of animals will be killed the next day by men just before going hunting, a partridge breastbone is burnt or scorched before the fire. The shape of the scorched portion suggests, by a vague resemblance, the form of the animal to be hunted.
Wing tips. The tips of the wings of birds that are killed for food are preserved about the camp for good luck, or as the Algonquins say, to ask for more luck. Some hunters also preserve the skulls of all the game they kill. If they throw these parts of the animals away, they won't be able to find what creatures they may look for afterward.
Blue bottles. If blue bottle flies are killed, it will bring rain. Rabbit hair. If, in winter, rabbit's hair is thrown into the smoke of a fire, as it rises in the heat toward the sky, it will cause snow the next day. Children are scolded when they do these things at the wrong time.
The naming of fish bones. In the body of a fish are various bones which the Algonquins liken to different utensils and tools in their hunter's outfit. There is a gun, spear, bow and arrow, knife, paddle, sled, snowshoe, awl, etc. This is merely a saying.
Left-handed people. Another idea is that a left-handed person is clever because he fools people by the way he does things.
Ancient bear feast. When a bear has been killed, the families in the neighborhood assemble at a camp conveniently near. The hunter who has killed the bear becomes the host of the occasion, which is called a megoshibin. Slabs of birch bark are spread upon a clear space of ground to serve as a sort of table. The carcass is then butchered, the head being cut off, including the first vertebrae. The long piece of breast fat is also cut off with the head so that the two remain together. The head with this mass of breast fat is then put into a separate cooking vessel. Then the birch bark slabs, often 12 feet long, forming the cover of some wigwam, are covered with the cut-up portions of the meat. Birch bark dishes are placed for each participant on the bark with extra dishes for the gravy. The grease from the cooking vessels is then collected and put into a separate vessel to cool, so that it will be thick enough to drink. When the meat has been boiled properly, all the guests are seated at their places around the bark spread. Often they have a dance around it at this time. Before they begin to eat, the chief goes around to each guest and with a big wooden spoon, holding about a cupful and a half, and gives each a spoonful of grease. They then begin to eat. When the feast is about half through, the chief gets up and decorates the bear's head with brightly colored ribbons about 6 inches long and attached to little cedar sticks about 4 inches long, with their ends split to hold the ribbons. These ribbon streamers are stuck into the fat and about the head. Then the bear's head itself is impaled on a stick, and carrying this in his hand, the chief dances twice around the company, singing a tune to a burden of syllables. After this performance, the chief plants the stick with the head upon it in the middle of the spread before all the guests, where it is left. Then they finish eating. After the feast, the oldest and most venerable man in the camp is presented with the head and the attached breast fat, which he may either take home or distribute over again to the company. After the feast is over, the chief must go around and consume what grease is left. This is to demonstrate his capacity as a man and a hearty eater. After all is over, the lower jawbone is tied to the skull in its proper position, and black stripes are painted on the skull. This is then put on the stub end of a branch of a tree, facing some prominent point toward the river or lake, near the water's edge. Here it can be seen by passers-by as a reminder of the place and occasion of the bear feast. The Algonquins themselves give little comment on the meaning or reason of this ceremony, except that it is done from respect to the bear and satisfaction in securing a bountiful supply of meat. It belongs to the variously expressed series of bear rites widespread among the northern tribes.
The butterfly song is traditionally sung during the time frame when they are in season. As this podcast is available at any time throughout the year, permission was given to include this beautiful song performed by Mary and Ava.
Way up, oh, higher. Way up, oh,
also known as Whiskey Jack, a gray jaybird, is a trickster character whose adventures are often humorous. Frank Speck collected these legends, or adeusokan, of Whiskey Jack on his travels along the Ottawa River between Temiskaming and Pembroke, and so near enough to the Pickwakanagon First Nation at Golden Lake that they are likely to be relevant to them, if not widely known in their own oral folktale histories.
Whiskey Jack pursues the beaver. Whiskey Jack was traveling about looking for adventures. He never succeeded in anything he tried to do. He never did well and was always hungry. In his travels, he came to Turn Back Lake. Now he had no canoe, but he was a great swimmer. When he came to Turn Back Lake, he found it too big to swim, so he started to walk around it. He wanted to hunt beaver. On one side of the lake, he came to a round, high mountain that looked like a beaver lodge. In front of it, he found deep water, just as there is in front of a beaver lodge. And a little way offshore, there was a little island with many grasses. Just as the beaver provides a winter supply of greens for himself near his lodge. So this island, Whiskey Jack, supposed to be the beaver's winter supply in the mountain his lodge. Whiskey Jack wanted to get this great beaver, but he did not know how to get him. He thought of draining the lake, so he went way around to the lower end and broke away the dam so that the water would run off. Soon, the water began to go, and Whiskey Jack lingered about, waiting for it to get low enough to get the beaver. Pretty soon, he took a nap. When he woke up, it was rather late, and he hurried back to the mountain, only to find that the beaver had gone. The beaver might have escaped over the dam with the water, so he started back, and sure enough, he saw the beaver going down over the dam. "Now," said he, "I lost my beaver." He followed hard after him and had lots of trouble to keep up. He followed him past the Coolong River and the Pembroke Lakes. But when the beaver reached the Calumet Chutes, he was afraid to go through and took the portage. Then Whiskey Jack saw him and chased him hard over the portage. When he got to the lower end, he lost sight of the beaver and started back up the Ottawa River. When he got to the upper end of the portage, he saw fresh tracks. "Well," said he, "there has been somebody here. I wonder if I could trace him. We might have something to eat." Then he followed the track to the lower end of the portage, where he had already been, but nobody was there. So he went back to the upper end of the portage, and there more fresh tracks leading to the lower end. These he followed to where he had been twice before, but saw no beaver. He then discovered that they were his own tracks that he had been following and gave it up. These tracks, back and forth, can be seen plainly today imprinted in the stone of Calumet Portage, which the Algonquins call Whiskey Jack tracks. After this, he started off on another trip.
Whiskey Jack kills a bear. Whiskey Jack was always in trouble. One time he was going along the shore of a big lake, carrying a big pail. He felt very hungry and was looking for something to eat. Pretty soon he saw a lot of clumps of high bush cranberries and commenced to eat from one little clump to another. He then remembered his pail. Said he, "If I could pick my pail full, I would have a good supply to last me a long while." So he began filling his pail, and as he went on, he got into some big clumps. Suddenly, he saw a big bear sitting down among some bushes. Every little while rubbing his eyes and pushing out his paws, as though something was hurting his eyes. Whiskey Jack watched him a while and thought how nice it would be to kill him. What a big supply of food he would have to fill his pail. So he went up to the bear and said, "Hello, bear. What's the matter with you?" The bear answered, "Oh, my eyes are so sore, and I can't see where to go. I just wish somebody would help me." "Well, come along with me. I will help you. I know where to get some fine medicine that will fix you up all right." "Very well," said the bear. Whiskey Jack led him off to a big bunch of cranberries. There he gathered a lot of berries and crushed them in his hands. He then told the bear to open his eyes so that he could put the medicine on. "It may hurt you when I put this medicine in, but it will cure you, so don't mind it." Then Mishakajak began to rub the cranberry juice into the bear's eyes. The bear began to roar and tear around with the pain, making a great noise. "Never mind," said Wishakajak, "it may hurt, but it will cure you." In the meantime, Wishakajak hunted around and got two big stones, and while the bear was blinded with the pain, he began pounding him on the head with the stones. He had a hard fight all over the berry patch, but finally succeeded and killed the bear. Then Wishakajak went back to where he had left his pail and got his knife. He skinned the bear and cut him up. He put some of the pieces into his pail to make a bouillon. Then he got sticks and made a fire for the cooking. Next, he got some birch bark by peeling it off a tree and cleaned a big space near the fire and spread the birch bark to put the meat on before sticking the pieces of meat on sharp sticks. When they were well roasted, Wishakajak spread them on the bark to cool before eating them. He left the bear's head for the last, and then he began to eat lots of the bear's fat and the meat. He had a great big pile of it. He sat down to enjoy his meal. Now, just as he was ready to begin, the wind began to blow a little, and at the same time, from above, came a little cry, "Tita Koshkawan." He looked around because it bothered him, but could not see anything, so he started to eat again. Then the same little cry sounded again, "Tita Koshkawan," and he stopped to look around, but couldn't see anything. The third time he started to eat, the same cry sounded, and then he got up and hunted for the cause, for it bothered him and was spoiling his good time. When he looked up, he saw a tree that had been blown down resting in the crotch of another tree over him. It rubbed when the wind blew and made that noise. Wishakajak spoke to the tree, "You had better stop that noise until I get through eating. I don't like it at all." "Oh," said the tree, "I have to do it. I can't stop it." Whenever Wishakajak started to eat again, the wind blew a little. Then Wishakajak climbed the tree and put his hands in between the tree and the crotch to stop the rubbing. And when the wind blew a little, the space spread and closed again. It pinned his hands in the crotch and held him fast. "Let me go, let me go," he begged of the tree. "I must get down to my meat." But the only answer he got was no. There he stayed. Pretty soon then he looked down and saw a squirrel come and take some of his meat. He shouted for him to go away without any success. Next came the marten, then the fisher, then some wild cats, then ravens, and in fact, all kinds of animals came and began to eat up his supply of meat. He tried to drive them away, but couldn't. The more he shouted at them, the more they danced and sang and ran off mocking him. They carried away all his pieces of meat to their dens, but didn't touch the pail of grease. By the time all the meat was gone, a little breeze arose and the tree let him go. When he got down, all was cleared away. There were not even bones enough for bouillon. There was only the grease in the pail. "Well," said he, "I'll have grease anyway." The bear's bladder was hanging in some willow trees where he had thrown it when he had cut him up. And then he went over and filled the bladder with the grease so that he could cool it. He tied the neck of the bladder so that it would hold the grease. "Now," he said to himself, "even if they have taken all my meat and bones, I'll have the grease. I'll just tie it by a string to a stick and let it float in the river until it is cool, and then I'll make a good meal of that anyway." So he tied the bladder of the grease to a stick and let it swing in the current of the river to cool it. A muskrat came along. "Quay muskrat, where are you going?" said Wishakajak. "Oh, anywhere," answered the muskrat. "Well then, come work for me," said Wishakajak. "Come tie this bladder on your tail and swim further out into the deep water where it is cold and cool it for me. Don't swim too fast and go easy or you might break the bladder and spill my grease." "All right," said the muskrat. "I will do it for you and you will tell me how fast to go." Then Wissekajak tied it to the muskrat's tail, and the muskrat started off with it. Meanwhile, Wissekajak made a plan. The muskrat swam way out. "Hold on," said Wissekajak, "you're going too fast." But the muskrat swam further, and then he got far enough. He snapped the string with his tail, broke the bladder, and dove out of sight. The grease spread all over the water. Wissekajak cried and ran out into the water and tried to scoop up the grease in his hands to save some of it, but it escaped him. When he had lost his grease, he thought of his bullion and went back to his pail, but when he got there, he found that the wolverine had come and eaten it all up. Then he searched about to see if he could find a small bone. There was not a thing left. After a while, he saw a string of little ants going back and forth from under a log. "I wonder what they are doing," he thought. "Maybe they have something hidden under there." He followed them and looked under the log, and there were the ants eating away on the bear's skull, devouring the brains. "If I could get in there myself, I could get some of these brains," he said. He tried different ways to reach in, but he could not get at it. "If I could only put my head in that hole, I could eat some. I wish my head was as small as a snake's head. Then I could get in it." His head began to get small like a snake's head, and he poked it inside the skull and began eating a great snack. He licked the skull clean and said, "Well, I had a meal. Now if I could only get up and out, I would be all right." But when he tried to get his head clear of the skull, he could not, because his head had turned back to its original size and was fast inside the skull. He couldn't see where he was going. Then he sat down on a log, thinking what to do next. "If I knock my head against a rock, I might break my own head." Then he wondered about the Algonquins and started off in search of a camp to get help. He was blinded by the skull and could not see where he was going. Soon he banged against a tree. "What's your name?" he asked of the tree. "Maple," was the answer. "While I'm in high ground, I won't find any people camping way up here." Soon he banged against another tree. "What's your name?" he asked. "Beech," was the answer. "I'm still in high ground," he said. "I must strike lower ground." Soon he banged against another tree and asked its name. It answered White Pine. "Still in high ground," he said, "but getting lower." The next tree he bumped against proved to be a Red Pine. "Still in high ground. No Algonquins would camp here." At last he banged against a balsam and then a spruce. "I'm getting on low ground now," he said. Pretty soon he got into ragged bush and struck a rough bark tree. "What's your name?" he asked. "Cedar," said the tree. "Aha! Now I'm in low ground and may strike a camp at last." He went on and soon got into very tight bush and struck an alder. "Aha! Now I am close to a lake. I will soon find a camp." Next he got tangled in some knee-high twigs. He asked them what their name was. They told him willows. He said, "I am near a lake." "Yes," they answered. "Can you see people?" "Yes, at yonder point there is a camp," they answered. "Is it far?" he asked. "No, not far," they said. So he went on and got into something still lower. "What's your name?" he asked. "Grass," was the answer. He walked on and got into water deeper and deeper. "If the people would only see me, I would be all right," he said. Next, he started to swim. He splashed about and made a noise to attract the people if any were about. Suddenly, he remembered about the skull on his head and said, "If the Algonquins see me, they might think that I'm a bear and try to kill me." So he swam on. Sure enough, the Algonquins saw him. They recognized Wissekajak by his antics and thought he was trying to play some trick on them. So they laughed about it and quietly paddled up close to him. They pretended that they thought he was a bear and made out as though they were going to kill him. Wissekajak swam as hard as he could for all his life. "Hand me my axe," said one of the Algonquins, "till I kill him." "Stand aside till I shoot him with my arrow," said another. "Hurry up, paddle hard, or we'll lose him," said a third. They all kept shouting and making a great pretense to get after him, all the time laughing at Wissekajak and splashing with their paddles, as though trying to keep up with him. Wissekajak struggled ahead in great fear, expecting any moment to be killed. At last he got across the lake on the other shore, and his feet struck bottom. He landed on a flat rock with the Algonquins close behind him. Suddenly he slipped and fell on his head. The bear's skull cracked and fell off and left his head free. He then saw the Algonquins. "Don't shoot, don't shoot," he cried. "I'm with Shekajuk." He then took to the bush and escaped.
Wee Shekajuk invites the ducks to a dance. Wee Shekajuk was always hungry. One time, in the autumn of the year, he noticed the flocks of ducks flying south and how fat they were. He then made up his mind to try and get some of them for a good food supply against the winter. He decided to make a big dance among the birds in the autumn and to invite all the ducks and geese to come so that he could kill them. He set to work and built a big wigwam and cleaned a nice place around the outside. He built a little fire in the middle of the wigwam and fixed a nice space all around it for the dance to take place. Then he made his door out of birch bark so that the center stick, which keeps the bark spread, extended over the ends of the bark and kept it from opening inwards. Everything was about ready, so he then went to see a duck and said to him, "Soon you will be going away south to be gone all winter and not come back until next spring. It will be a long time before I will see you again, so I want to get up a dance for you all. You go and invite all your friends, the ducks, the geese, and all the others who go south." "All right," said the duck. So he got ready and went back to his wigwam to wait for the company. To help invite the birds, he sat down in front of it and got his drum and rattle and began singing a song of invitation. As the ducks came flying by overhead, they heard Wee Shekajuk's song and came down to join the party. He sang in song and told them, "You are going away to be gone until next spring, and I won't see you for a long time, so I want to get up and dance for you all before you go." A lot of them came down and gathered a crowd outside. Then he said, "Now, let's go inside and have a good time." And he opened the door, and they all went in. Then he fixed the small fire in the middle so that it would just be enough light to see a little. "Now," said he, "you must obey the rule of this dance and do whatever you are told when you hear the order." He sat down on one side of the fire near the door, and they all began dancing around. They got well mixed up before long, geese, ducks, loons, all kind of birds, even some grebes. When he got them warmed up, Wee Shekajuk said, "Now, you must all close your eyes and not open them until I give the word." They obeyed and kept on dancing with their eyes closed. Then, while their eyes were closed, Wee Shekajuk got up, began wringing the neck out of one after another. The noise of dancing prevented them from hearing what he was doing. Pretty soon, a grebe began to suspect that Wee Shekajuk was moving around. So he danced over into a dark corner where Wee Shekajuk could not see him and opened one of his eyes a little to peep out. There he saw Wee Shekajuk going among the dancers, wringing their necks. He called out, "Wee Shekajuk is killing you! Fly!" They opened their eyes and saw what was happening and took wing and flew away. The grebe was way up in the corner. Wee Shekajuk jumped at him and gave him a kick to its behind, and that knocked him out of shape. Wee Shekajuk then kicked the grebe out of the door and cried, "Now go, you little rascal!" The grebe flew off, and ever since then, grebe have been out of shape. His feet are so far back that he cannot walk on land. Wee Shekajuk did not eat all the ducks that he had killed after all. He was just a curious lad, that Wee Shekajuk.
Wee Shekajuk disguises himself as a lynx. One time in winter, Wee Shekajuk was going along and fell upon an Algonquin's trail. He followed the tracks of the snowshoes and soon came to a place where the Algonquin had set his rabbit snares. Wee Shekajuk saw the rabbits in the snares. He followed on and finally came to where a lynx was caught in a snare. He thought it was a very curious-looking creature. The lynx's eyes were bulging out from being choked in the snare, and his teeth showed. Now Wee Shekajuk admired the lynx's bulging eyes. "Don't you think your eyes are very pretty?" he asked the lynx. "No, not very," answered the lynx, because everything, living or dead, had to reply when Wee Shekajuk asked a question. Wee Shekajuk was very eager to get pretty eyes like the lynx's, So he made a fire and roasted the poor lynx to get its skin off. Weeshakajak then took out his own eyes and pulled the lynx's skin over his own head, so that the bulging eyes of the lynx fitted into his own eye sockets. Then Weeshakajak went on his travels, very well pleased with his looks. But he found out that with the lynx's eyes, he could only see well at night. So after a while, he became dissatisfied with the new eyes. But he had thrown his own away, so he had to make the best of it. He could only travel at night on account of his new eyes. So he had to make his living on rabbits, stealing them from the Algonquin's snares. They were all he could get. One day as he was going along, he stopped and looked at his tracks. Then he discovered that his paws were big and broad, and so spread out when he walked, they resembled snowshoes. They were so broad that he could walk over the snow without snowshoes. So he went on until he decided to watch for Algonquins. So he sat down on a log near a hunter's path. He waited all night and part of the day. Finally, some Algonquins came along the path to visit their rabbit snares. As they passed, they found the rabbits stolen from all their snares, but they did not mind it very much. Sometime after, one of the Algonquin's little children came along the trail and saw Weeshakajak with his big face and bulging eyes sitting on the stump. The child ran back to the camp and told his parents that he saw a big wildcat with bulging eyes staring at him from a stump. Then the father of the child took his arrowhead club and went to where the child said he saw the wildcat and started clubbing Weeshakajak, trying to kill him. The fight was pretty bad when Weeshakajak cried out, "Hold on, hold on. It isn't a lynx. It is Weeshakajak that you are pounding to death." And Weeshakajak tore off the lynx skin and pitched it away. Then he took to the bush, and that's the last I saw of him.
Our program concludes with a wildflower song sung by Diane, Ada, and Noreen.
I'm going to introduce the wildflower song, which was gifted by the ancestors to Barbara Sarah Hooper, and she has given us permission to sing this song for you today. The real story of the wildflower. The song came after my first powwow years ago at Lake Ontario Park. When everyone had gone home, I was standing on my porch feeling very sad about that. But I could still hear the sound of the drum. I moved from the porch inside to my kitchen. Then I went away in a waking dream. I saw myself as a young woman wearing a buckskin in front of a lodge. All of a sudden, I heard some commotion above on the hill. There were men mounting their horses to ride into conflict or commotion of some kind. Immediately, I started calling to the children to gather them to safety. Ya-hey-ya-hey-ya-hey-ya-hey. In this waking dream, I held a baby in my arms. The baby was one of the drummers at the powwow. When I came out of the waking dream, there were tears streaming down my face. I was kneeling. The psalm came up through me, but I didn't know why. The name Wildflower came from an old man I saw before. In that dream, I was the same young woman as I was in the waking dream, this time standing beside an old man with long white hair in front of the same lodge. He was wrapped in a blanket sitting before a sacred fire. His legs were separated from his body. He said he was waiting for me to return. While I was singing the song the next day for a friend by the water, I heard the voice of the same old grandfather clearly say to me, "Wildflower, a song for all women who live in the state of nature." Now, many years later, I hear the wildflower song is sung by women across this country and beyond at small and large gatherings. They often call children to the drum circle to sing with them. Some women have asked for and received my agreement to record what has resulted in slightly modified agreements of Wildflower on selective CDs. Wildflower is often referred to as Barb's song, but I did not compose it. Rather, I believe it was gifted to me from the Four Directions through the drum. As such, some people call it the traditional song. When women sing it, we honor all women because women are the closest to the earth as life givers. So some also call wildflower an honor song. Just as we don't own the earth, we don't own but carry family or spirit songs and stories. I understand some of us are the keepers of them. In our songs and stories, we contain the history and culture, knowledge of our people. Therefore, to respect the ancestors, we share this understanding at special times. So it is with wildflower.
Enjoy this introduction to the rich culture and worldview of one of the Algonquin nations. Chimigwech, big thank you to Diane Martin, Ada Tinney, Noreen Tinney, Mary Cannon, Ava Anderson, and members of the Algonquin community who generously shared their knowledge and time in order to create this program. We are honored. Many thanks to Richard Jodray of the Annex Junius Music Studio in Maynooth, Ontario, for recording and editing this podcast, and to Barry Conway for his mentorship. For the Opiongo Line, this is producer Ann Wild, wishing you a good day. Aminu Kididat.
That was Anne K. Wild's Algonquin Voices, a presentation prepared with the essential help and unique talents of several York River Valley women from the Hastings Highlands. They have given us a rare glimpse at some elements of their local Algonquin culture in terms of song, folk tales, and indigenous legends. For their remarkable effort, we give them a special thanks this Thanksgiving weekend. I'm Kristen Marchand, and for the producer of the Opiongo Line, Barry Conway, we'd like to wish all our unique listeners in all 36 countries a very happy Upper Ottawa Valley Thanksgiving. Good day, and God bless.